Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Angela Pugh here. I'm recording in Tampa, Florida, with someone that I found on Instagram. She's so awesome. Her Instagram is awesome. And I'll tell you why she fascinated me here in a minute, but I DM'd her and asked her if she would be on the show, and she is here. So let's take a second to welcome Lara Frazier to the pod.
Hi.
Hi, Lara. Thank you.
I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you for doing this with me.
Of course.
I'm so excited to finally get to meet you in real life.
I know. Too. I can't believe we're in person together. IRL. This is insane.
IRL.
I've never done a podcast like live with another person in front of me.
I feel really young. When you text me and you said IRL, I was like, oh, look at me. I know what that means.
You are very young.
I'm 46. I'm still hip.
You are very hip.
Okay. So I saw on your Instagram, you had posted something, and you'll have to like correct me, because obviously I'm not going to say it exactly right. But you had posted something that said, I stopped going to AA and I'm still sober, or here I am 2 years later, I'm still sober, something like that. And I so love that, because most of my listeners know I am a 12-stepper. I'm an AA person inside and out. I love it. It saved my life. But I'm also a huge supporter of any other way that anybody wants to do it. So part of my mission with the podcast is to kind of open up what the 12 steps are and what it means to be a part of that community and make it seem less weird, because it does have a weird reputation and people think it's mystical or something. It really is not, but it is helpful. So to shed some light on that, but also to shed light on, there are all other kinds of ways to get sober and live a sober lifestyle. And I love that so many younger people are making that choice now. And I just think it's incredible, and I want everybody to know. So that's why Lara is with us today. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how you made the decision to get sober and what you did.
Yeah. So I got addicted to prescription pills. I was in a car accident and I got prescribed opiates. I had tried to get off of those opiates, and a psychiatrist had actually prescribed me an antidepressant, Xanax and Ambien, because I was like, I had quit, but I was like feeling withdrawn. I was depressed, and I didn't know, I had never experienced that before. And so I was like, I'm very depressed. I think I was addicted to these pills. Help me. So he prescribed me that. And then a couple years later, he prescribed me Adderall. So, and that was when I called him, because I had lost a job opportunity and told him I was suicidal. And he's pretty much like, I have the answer for you. Didn't know what that answer was, but it was Adderall. And so, and this began later in my life, like around probably 23 was when I first started like really getting addicted to pills. Before that, I was someone who was like very ambitious, very dedicated. I had a huge focus on like education and good grades, and being like that type of person who was obsessed with being successful,
right,
in their career. And so I got addicted to Adderall, and it brought me into drug-induced psychosis. I lived on the streets. I was in and out of rehab, psych wards. Just really, I mean, it took me down fast. So that's kind of the good thing, is that it took me down fast.
Right.
The better thing is that I had parents who showed up for me, who loved me unconditionally, and who would find me when I was lost in California and they had no idea where I was. My parents would fly from Texas to LA to like walk the streets with a picture of me asking, like, have you seen this girl?
I feel like now I need to have your parents on.
You should have my parents on. It would be,
I love those stories.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's a beautiful story. So they set limits and boundaries. However, they always answered my call, and I always knew I was loved. And that was what was really important for me, because there are times like when I almost tried, half committed suicide.
Right,
and then I
right.
was like, my parents love me. Like, I have people in the world who love me. And so with their help, I finally went to my last treatment center. I have an experience, obviously, with substance use disorder and then also love addiction, because my previous times in rehab, I had been kicked out a few times for getting into relationships with guys. And so,
oh, how people love to do that when
yes,
they go to
my rehab romance. I met many of my future husbands there. and so I went to get treatment for love addiction. My parents were like, listen, like she has two issues, you know? Right. And this place said, well, we'll never kick her out. Like, we take the toughest cases. Don't worry. And within 3 weeks of being there, I was being threatened to be kicked out because I was having relations with a male there. Luckily, I stuck through it. I learned, obviously, like much more about my love addiction, which I think was preventing me from getting sober.
Sure.
I had the medical director tell me, like, you're never going to get sober unless you deal with your issues with men. And other people had said that, but I don't know why, but his history was sex addiction. And so coming from someone who kind of had like a similar experience as me, and he meant it compassionately and he showed me empathy. And so I listened to that. And so when I got out of treatment, I went to a all-female sober living. I lived there for a year, which was actually like truly one of the reasons I believe I'm in long-term recovery
Without
today.
A doubt. Yeah. That's so good that you stayed a year too.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I was a house manager. Aww. And I got like little awards for being a good good resident. But it's funny
That's
because...
That's so good. Maybe I need to start giving awards at my sober living. That's a good idea.
We'll be... And it's ironic because in all the treatment centers, I was always the one getting in trouble. So it's like, what the heck happened? I don't know. Obviously a miracle happened.
Okay, wait. How long ago was this?
This was in 2014, the beginning of 2014.
Okay, so it's been a minute. But I knew for sure it had to be more recent because you're talking about love addiction.
Yeah.
And those weren't, like, even in the beginning of my sobriety, like, that's not something that was talked about that much.
Yeah.
Even sex addiction, not so much. Certainly not as openly as it is now.
Well,
and I love that. And I love that. But I love that you recognized that was an issue.
Well, it took me a bit of time. I didn't necessarily recognize. I knew it was like, there's something going on with me and men, but I didn't want to fix it. Like, I still wanted, if I couldn't get high off my drugs,
right,
then I wanted to find a new way to get high. I didn't want to be like in pain and be okay.
And a lot of people don't realize that liking somebody, like that infatuation or puppy love, as people call it, like there's a whole chemical thing that happens inside of you when you're engaged in that.
It did.
And it is a euphoria. I mean, I think everybody recognizes that, but they don't realize that there's biological part to that too.
Yeah, there is.
And of course, as addicted people, we will misuse that as much as anything else.
I definitely misused it a lot. And even what I realized, however, though, is like, even before I started using substances, I had an addiction to like success, being like, you know, getting good grades or like performing well or being the best student in the class or whatever.
Right.
But also within treatment, I did a relationship history. And so I had to like list out every relationship I was in since my first one. And what I saw was relationship to relationship to relationship with very little time in between. So I didn't necessarily ever notice that until it was like laid out on paper.
Right.
And then when I was being treated for it, I finally started to learn more about what it was. I became interested in learning about, I started like reading all the books they were suggesting. I was obviously going to Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous for a little bit of time.
Right.
And then like obviously just getting treatment for it and realizing like all these underlying issues I had that I never thought I had before. And I even went to a sex and love addiction therapist while I was in sober living. So besides the medical director saying what he said about not being able to get sober unless I dealt with my relationship issues with guys, my psychiatrist also told me the best way to measure a woman's health is to look at her relationships with other females. And at that time, I didn't have any relationships with other females. I had really pushed them all away. And I noticed that while I was like in treatment and in and out of sober living and such, I was always hanging out with guys. And so I had to look at that. And so I had to start developing relationships with other females. And so that was why the female sober living home was really important for me. And even in, so I went to something called Drug Addicts Anonymous, which is, we read from the big book, but we just replaced the word alcohol for drug. So it was more like AA as opposed to NA.
Right.
And even within that fellowship, I hung out with women. I even, you know, I'd get a little bit distracted, but then I'd get back on track. And I wouldn't, like, I didn't have the ability to be friends with a male at that point. It just wasn't possible for me. I had tried it before. I stopped, I like set boundaries. I stopped answering calls from all these ex-boyfriends that I met in rehab, which was really the first time I'd ever done that. Because usually they'd be like something I could fall back on for attention, sure, or to make me feel better about myself. So I'm not suggesting that's the answer for everyone, but it definitely helped me.
Right.
My experience in recovery is that, so I joined that fellowship, DAA. I worked the steps very quickly. I was very like grateful for that group, for my sponsor, for what it did for me. I definitely felt that that was something that I needed. I don't believe that's what everyone needs, right, but at that time it was what I needed. And I couldn't have imagined a different path or a better path. Also, I didn't know there was another way. I didn't know there were other pathways to recovery. I thought recovery was conditional. I had to work the 12 steps and I had to have a spiritual experience or else I would never get sober. Right. That was honestly my belief.
Right.
And so when I would see people like saying something like how they're in recovery, but they didn't do AA, like I'm like, well, they're probably not really in recovery. Like I didn't really believe that was possible.
Or you think, I feel like I hear this a lot and have caught myself doing the same thing. Years ago, I would be like, they're probably not really going to stay sober.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah, I do believe in the process behind the 12 steps, right? There is, it is just about healing. You know, it's psychology 101. You can take it even farther back than that to the beginning of time and ancient philosophers. Like, there really is nothing weird about the 12 steps. So I believe in that process. And I think I had to do those things and it made me stronger for sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think that you have to do it in the confines of AA and the 12 steps. I think you can have that same experience in other ways.
I do too. And one thing though that I did learn, which I had not thought was possible before, is that there are thousands of women I know who have reached out or written letters or something who have gotten sober without God, or without saying that they had a spiritual experience. And that was something very important for me to learn and understand, because I kept saying like, well, you don't have to be in a 12-step fellowship, but you do have to have like some kind of higher power. And the truth of the matter is that there are women who have been sober for 10, 20 years and they don't necessarily believe in a higher power or anything like that, but they're rocking their recovery and they have joy for lives. So that was like my own ignorance, and something that today I still speak openly about, because for me, although I have a deep relationship with a higher power who I call God, it doesn't mean that everyone has to do that.
Right.
So,
well, and that keeps people away from 12-step fellowships too, because they think God is such an important part of it. And that was a part of my train of thought also in the beginning, like when I got to the place that I knew I had to get sober, right? All I knew is when people don't want to drink anymore, they go to AA. It's like, of course, yeah, that's where too. I'm going to go, right? Yeah. That's where everybody goes.
Yeah.
So, and I had the same train of thought where I was like, well, I'm not religious, right? I'm not religious in the way that I go to a church or follow a specific text, or like I don't do any of that, and didn't have a lot of interest in doing that. And again, totally ignorant at that time. I was so ignorant to almost everything.
Yeah. Really.
And I've learned a very different way now. And I am a super spiritual person now, but it's way more along the lines of, you know, the universe and karma and things of that nature. But thinking about the God piece and thinking that it had to be a set religion really kept me out of the rooms for a while.
Yeah.
So I like talking about that piece too, because it is a higher power of your understanding, or you don't have to have that part at all if you really don't want to. But if you need help, you got to go get help.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Don't let those things hold you back. That's my thing. Don't let that stuff hold you back.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, even if you're not, you don't do AA and you don't have a higher power, you can still be in recovery and living an awesome life. Like, it's not the only way.
Yeah.
And the reason I have to continually promote multiple pathways and talk about my own experience, and this is why I really do it, is because leaving AA, so I came to a point in my recovery where I felt like I wasn't growing. Nothing was changing. Like, you know, I kept being told to pray and I would pray and still the same. And I started like finding other women who were recovering outside of AA, also finding women who were recovering in AA, but supporting people who didn't recover with AA. And that was something I hadn't seen. And I started realizing there are like all these other paths to sobriety and recovery. And I had been so ignorant and judgmental to that, that I like, for example, I talk a lot about Holly Whitaker of Hip Sobriety, because she was, I went through her school and she was one of the people who held my hand through me leaving AA. And it, without her, I nearly relapsed over leaving AA because I was so traumatized, devastated. Honestly, like the people I looked up to the most just kept telling me that I can't, like, no, you're wrong. You can't leave. You're gonna drink or use again if you leave. And even though my heart and my soul were telling me like, it's okay to step out of this and do something different that feels right for me, the community that I had built within that fellowship didn't necessarily believe that or trust that.
Right.
And I can't, I'm not mad at AA as a whole for that.
Yeah,
it
sure.
is the people, but many people go through that experience.
Well, and I remember being fearful. Like I remember at like 2 years sober, like where I almost got mad at the program because I had this fear built up that like, if I skipped even a single day, like I would, you know, I was going to be struck down and relapse that night, you know, because you do hear that so often when people stop going to meetings, when you stop going to meetings, it's not too long until people start drinking again.
Yeah.
And not even saying that I don't believe that, right? Because sometimes it that happens
happen.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I was almost resentful because I had that fear, you know, and I didn't miss a meeting. Like I was in, I didn't miss a meeting.
Yeah.
I think for probably 5 years, I did not miss.
Every single day?
Every single day. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Listen, I really did not want to drink again.
Well, good for you. And if that's how you have to do it, then that's how you do
I
it.
I really more, did like, not want
to
drink.
You. Whatever people do to save their life is beautiful and incredible and amazing. And however they do that, I don't want to judge them on that.
Right.
And,
that's exactly how I feel. That's exactly how I feel. I, like I said, I don't care what anybody does. Just do something.
Yeah.
I just want people to do something rather than do nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think that it's so necessary to get hung up on the words. I feel like a lot of times it's semantics. Like people get hung up on, I had a kid not very long ago to say to me, I don't want to pray. I'm not praying. They can't make me pray. I was like, nobody even cares. You first of all, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But then after the meeting, you know, we stand, hold hands and say a prayer. And I looked at him and I go, you just prayed, by the way. You know, like he just wanted to be hung up on fighting that one word.
Yeah.
And I'm like, dude, you're just making it a bigger deal than it is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I know. I know. Also, though, I will say on the flip side is that for me, what I realized and started to see is that like, and there's many, I'm sure you being an active member of AA can speak differently about this. But like for me, I didn't want to look at my like powerlessness. I wanted to feel empowered. I didn't want to talk about my faults or my defects.
Right.
I wanted to talk like I wanted to look into the future and my growth. I didn't want to be, I didn't no longer wanted to label myself as an addict or alcoholic.
Right.
And I don't do that today. And that's okay. You can do that in AA. You can believe all these things and still be an AA.
Right.
I totally get that.
Right.
You definitely can. You can just be like, hey, my name's Lara and I don't drink. Like you don't have to label yourself. However, like for me, it was just all these things that were coming up that was just like, this isn't the right place for me anymore. And I'm allowed to step out and grow. The sad thing, and the reason I bring this up, I'm just talking about why I wrote the article.
Right.
But the sad thing was like, I lost that community of women who I really, really looked up to. And that was sad for me because it's like, I get it from both sides. So for me, it was like, here are these women who have held my hand, who have answered my call, who have truly been inspiring to me. Even if I'm not in AA, they're still inspiring to me.
Right.
However, it was like little bit by little bit, like they, I mean, I just felt, not even like a little bit, I just felt like dropped. Like if my sponsor said she couldn't sponsor me anymore because I was unwilling to do all the commitments that I had been doing. And so I accepted that. And then I slowly started stepping away from that specific home group I was in. But like all those women who I had spent like all these weekends with, I didn't hear from them. Like,
right.
And so that was hard. And then even friends who I had met in sober living, some of them, like they kind of had to distance themselves. And I also think though, had I been an active member at a time when I had a friend who was leaving, for me, I might have had to distance myself to protect myself to be to be healthy. So I totally understand it. But now looking back on it, like the women who, you know, are in AA or NA, who were in my sober living, or who my friends were in Dallas that stuck by my side and didn't judge me and hung out with me, like now those women are like truly, truly very, very special to me because they supported me and they didn't judge me.
Right.
And I needed to not be judged. I needed to be accepted for where I was at and to be loved for where I was at and to know that, like, listen, I've been sober almost, I don 't know how long that was, like maybe 2.5 years. Like, I feel like I can trust myself. Like, I feel like I can listen to my own guidance. And I just wanted to be supported.
I think that's a huge piece. That's so important because I do have to have some level of willingness to really be honest with myself, right? Like, obviously, I don't go to the number of meetings today that I went to my first 5 years, right? Like, I mean, that would be some sort of miracle.
I know, if I'm still going every day.
Yeah. But I still go. I love it there. It's my safe place. I do not think that if I don't go for, you know, a month or something that I'm going to relapse. But I definitely hold myself to a higher standard, too, that I can't rationalize and justify negative behaviors or old behaviors, as we call them, right? Like anything. It's a couple of things. Anything I was doing in my 20s, which was my main drinking days, I'm in my 40s now. Anything I was doing in my 20s, I don't really have any business doing those things in my 40s.
Yeah.
But things that I was doing and behaviors that I would exhibit and how I made decisions as a drinking person, I certainly don't want to carry those behaviors into my sobriety.
Yeah.
Right. So I have to be painfully honest with myself and who I am and how I'm being. And I have to really hold myself accountable above and beyond anything else, you know? And I think that's where some people struggle too, is that rationalization or justification kicks in and you can rationalize almost any bad behavior, you know? So I just have to make sure I'm not doing that.
Yeah. No, definitely. And also another thing is that what I learned, my foundation in AA, there's so much, obviously, I do so much of that today. Like,
absolutely.
I pray, I meditate, I do hold myself accountable, I take inventory, I make amends when I'm wrong.
Right.
I am of service. You do not have to be an active member of AA to be of service. I don't know how many times I need to say that because that's like all the comments I got was like, she stole her sobriety. She got it from AA and then she left it and she's not there for that person in the room. What people don't realize is there are people outside of the room.
That's exactly
who need to recover too.
Yeah.
And I can be there for that person because I have that experience. And so, I mean, like I started my blog because not only does writing help me, but it also helps other people. And like, I remember how many women told their truth before I told mine. And it was like, wow, like that inspired me so much to hear women telling the truth about things. And that's what I want to do. I just want to be able to tell like my truth and I want to be able to be helpful to another person.
Right.
That's like the one, like the multiple comments on my piece that really got me frustrated because just because I'm not in AA any longer doesn't mean I'm not helping people. However, I also believe like if someone leaves AA and they don't want to be of service to people in recovery, that they don't have to be. Like they don't owe anything to anyone. For me, it's just part of who I want to be as a person.
Yes.
It's like a purpose and a calling and I want to do that. And so like,
that's why I always talk about my personal code of conduct. You know, like I do have a personal code of conduct in the human being that I want to be and the impression I want to leave in the world. And that's how I behave, you know, and that's how I create my life.
Yeah.
And it's so comfortable. And it is so many of those things that you mentioned that I learned in those rooms, you know, in 12 steps. Like that's where I learned that stuff. But you're so right, too. Like that doesn't mean you can only learn those things in those rooms. You can learn those things anywhere, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, life coaching was the first thing I did as a helping profession.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't say that really because I didn't do it as a profession. It was the first training I took because I was always fascinated with life coaching and thought I would be really good at it.
Yeah. You would be really good at it.
I went, well, I mean, now it's been my job for 100 years.
Yeah. Well, then you are really good at it, I mean.
But I didn't intend when I did the training, like I didn't intend to do it as work.
Yeah.
Like I really wanted, I was a couple of years sober and I just wanted some skills, you know, like I wanted some tools in my toolbox, as we say. And life coaching, to be honest with you, out of all of the education I've had, you know, I did an addiction counseling program. I did social work school. I studied neuropsychology. Like I love being a student, and I want to know everything. Yeah. So everything fascinates me. I spent endless hours researching and reading and writing. I just love all that stuff. But out of all of the formal education that I get to pay student loans for the rest of my life, out of all of that stuff, the greatest tools that I have, the most effective tools I have, are life coaching tools.
That's awesome.
And I feel like that is the core of kind of what the 12 steps are. Now, that's very much my perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't mean that anybody else has to feel that way. But I do really feel like it is a pretty basic program for living to just be a healthy, happy person.
Yeah.
And anybody could live by those principles.
Yeah, yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you're going to the fellowship or not.
Yeah.
You can still live by those principles.
Exactly. Yeah.
I work with plenty of people in my coaching practice. That's all I coach is exactly that lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And my people are living healthy and happy, and they're getting better, and they're creating better lives and doing all that stuff. And they don't have anything to do with the rooms.
I know. So, I mean, it's just growing as a human being.
Yeah.
And finding your own truth. Question for you, because I was thinking about this. So, as you know, I have a boyfriend, and he does like recovery coaching, or he was, and I don't like sell anything related to my stuff, but he did, like he would sell t-shirts or whatever. Do you ever get people, because I want to talk about this because I think it's an important message, is like people asking you like, oh, you're making money off your sobriety, as if the work you're doing, you're not allowed to make money from like work in that way.
Yeah. I think I even had that struggle internally a little bit at the beginning.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you, it really was based on my own self-esteem. So I finally hit a point that I realized how much I have sacrificed and how much I have invested in my education and my level of experience.
Yeah.
And I was like, it's not about getting paid. It's about, you want to help as many people as you can possibly help. And I deserve to be able to feed myself and my dog, just like everybody else deserves to be paid for their work.
Yeah.
There are some, with coaching, there are some pretty specific lines. Like, I don't work steps. Like, that's the difference between a recovery coach and a sponsor.
Yeah.
Right? I don't work steps with people.
Yeah.
But recovery coaching really is no different than life coaching.
Yeah.
It just has more of a focus on recovery.
Yeah.
But it is exactly the same thing.
Okay.
And I don't think anybody is that angry with Tony Robbins for getting paid to be a life coach.
I just want another woman to speak about it, because like, it's just so frustrating for me to see, like, I have friends too who do various things, and they keep getting called out as if they're not allowed to be like, you know, make, like, they're not worthy of making money.
Right.
It makes them feel that way. And like, even for me, like, I've thought of doing different things, but then my self-esteem is like, what are other people going to think about me? So it's important to hear like that message.
It's really important to me to make sure that my focus is always the message and it's not the money. And I think that's what people a lot of times don't understand too, is when you are really passionate about something and you're really good at it, the money is going to come.
Yeah, that's
right.
A good
point. Don't have to solicit anything, right? I don't have to solicit my services.
Yeah.
I'm not out, like, you look at my Instagram or my Facebook, I'm not selling services.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you,
people are attracted to you.
But people are attracted to you. That's right. And so I get offers to do speaking engagements and things like that. And I'm in talks right now to do some online courses,
that's
which I'm
awesome.
Really excited about.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's just a natural progression of what happens.
Yeah.
But I also, I guess I feel more, my self-esteem is better, but I also feel more deserving almost in a way, because the other part people don't realize is that I'm the one working 80 hours a week.
I know.
You know what I mean?
I know.
Like, I'm not just sitting back, you know, with my feet up on the ottoman in my office, like eating bonbons, napping with my dog and asking people to pay me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I work really, really hard to carry the message that is important to me and to help absolutely as many people as I possibly can. And that's what it's really about.
Yeah.
Like, if my focus shifted to the money and my focus became making money, I wouldn't feel good about myself either.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So my focus always has to be the message and the money will follow.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thanks. Sorry. Okay. I just had like a side question when I heard that, because you're like a very strong, powerful, confident woman. So it's like, I like hearing that from people like you.
Yeah. That's probably also why people wouldn't give me too much of a hard time.
Yeah, I know.
You know, because I don't get super connected when people want to be negative. Like, I don't get super connected to that because it's just not, it's weird. First of all, I'm a very positive energy person in general.
Yeah.
So I don't like focusing on negatives.
Yeah.
Like, I would never feel good if I thought I was doing something to hurt somebody or spreading a negative message. I don't know. I would never feel good about that stuff. But you also can't control what other people think and feel.
Yeah.
And it's so much more about their perspective and where they are in their life and their lack of happiness and their lack of self-esteem.
I know.
Right? Because when you're strong and you feel good and you're confident, I have zero desire to say anything bad about anybody.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't carve a special little piece of my time out of my day to write negative comments or something.
I know.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's just not my thing.
I know.
So I try not to get connected to that stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is.
Because it's more about them.
No,
I say the same thing like with gossiping. You know what I mean? When you're gossiping and talking about other people, it just shows really how insecure you are.
That's very true, too. Yes.
That's not fun. That's not a good look.
No, it's not. No, it's
and
not.
And that is not who I want to be in the world.
No,
you know?
I know.
I just don't like talking about
people. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you talking about that. Because as I've grown in my recovery and as a human being in general, like, I've become less connected to like negativity or negative comments. But like this last essay that I wrote, it was read by a lot of people. And so there were, and for some reason, it went somewhat viral like a couple weeks ago. And I started reading the comments and I was like, dear Lord, I never should have read the comments. But then I also am strong enough to know what people were saying was about them and their perspective. And it wasn't about me, even though it still hurts me.
Right.
Not quite where you're at.
Right.
But it's important to know that like what other people comment or think is about them, not usually
I think the thing that, because it still, I mean, it hurts. Like, I don't think anybody in the world is going to be comfortable thinking there are people out there with negative thoughts about you.
Yeah.
But the truth is, that's just it. You know, like I remember my sponsor saying to me really early on one time, he goes, do you think that everybody's thrilled every time you open your mouth? Good point.
Yeah.
It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
Like, obviously I'm not going to be everybody's favorite. I'm not everybody's cup of tea.
Yeah.
You know, and that's okay too.
Yeah.
Like, everybody doesn't have to love me. It's still, of course, it stings, you know, but I think what it is to me is more that people actually take the time to say something mean or hurtful, because there's a huge difference between being constructive. You know, if somebody wrote a comment on my podcast or something that was about, I don't know, maybe it sounds like crap. You know, I always have weird background stuff because I'm always recording in different places. So if somebody wrote something like that was really constructive, that wouldn't bother me.
Yeah.
But when people are just mean and hateful, it's like, gosh, dude, you don't, like, you really have that much time in your day that you could carve out this special little piece to say something mean. Like, it's just kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think to the other part of it that I try to remember is another thing my sponsor said to me. He said, you have to remember when you're in the lead, you're also in the line of fire.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. That's good.
That's a good point, too.
That's a good point.
See, sponsors can be very wise.
I know. They are. They are. Yeah. It's just a good way to look at it, because when people are talking about you, obviously your message is getting out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
even
true.
Even if they're being negative.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and what I have to focus on, too, is that my message is reaching the people it needs to reach, because if it's getting read by so many people and there are people who are messaging and commenting and emailing about how much it meant to them and like all the positive stuff about it. Like, I've spent that one day was a crap show. I don't know if you can cuss on
this
podcast.
You can say whatever you
want. Okay. Shit show. Because I read all these negative comments and I was like feeling like really upset. And then I finally realized like I need to focus on who this message was meant to reach, not who it's not meant to reach.
And have some focus too on how much that strengthens you.
Yeah.
Because that is one thing for sure. As you become more public and you get more in the public eye, people are going to take shots at you.
Yeah.
That's just the truth.
Yeah.
And it's not that it it's not that you ever get to a point. I think that it doesn't hurt somewhat, but that is a fact of it. So I always think, okay, you know what? I got to take that one. I got to take that one and I got to work my way through it and make sure I'm okay.
Yeah.
You know, but it does. I mean, it just strengthens your game.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Look at you life coaching me.
Right. I am a coach. Okay. So tell me about, talk to us a little bit about the love addiction piece.
Okay.
And what does recovery from love addiction look like? And how do you practice it to be healthier in relationships now?
Yeah. So now I don't like say I'm a love addict or anything. I say that I had a love addiction issue. I mean, what I've learned from just reading other people's work, not my own, is that like love isn't a bad thing. What is like the obsession or the need to use someone else to feel powerful or to be so selfish that you use another person just to feel better about yourself. What helped me, honestly, obviously going to treatment for it, not getting in a relationship for a year. I mean, that was like very, very tough for someone who had been in relationship after relationship and also someone who was going through an extreme amount of loneliness. So I learned how to be lonely and like painfully lonely because for a long, like I really hadn't been alone. Like even when I was using and isolating, I had a man around.
Sure. At least when you wanted him.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had to like learn to be like painfully okay with being alone. And that really prepared me to grow into like a better person because I finally got to know myself again. I'd been covering up who I was with drugs and alcohol and men for a long time. It allowed me to really reevaluate who I was and who I wanted to be. And I think I've always had a strong moral compass, always. My parents also modeled that to me. So I went to, like I said, a therapist for it. Honestly, the best thing I did was like read and read and read and learn as much as I could.
Right.
Like, so what would happen is like 4 months into my sobriety, I'd get a crush on someone and like, then I'd want their attention. And I would finally be self-aware enough to notice that it was a problem. And I would like talk with my sponsor about it. But I would then go back into my books and like what's going on here? And those would help me. Like they would like words help me. And
I'm the same way.
And then, I mean, and then practicing not acting out on my desires was helpful. Noticing like why I was doing the things I was doing and the reason behind it. I obviously think like the work I did in the 12 steps helped too. But I did get into a relationship with someone when I was about almost like a year. It's like, all right, my year's up. I can go on a date. No. And that was a fine relationship. Like it was probably one of the healthier relationships I'd been in the last 5 years. But like we weren't like meant to be together. And then when we broke up, you might hear Peaches breaking in right now. But when he broke up with me, I didn't like go try to find someone else, which is what my normal pattern would have been, was to like, okay, this guy broke my heart. Like I need another person to fill it. And so I just sat with that like sadness and I expressed gratitude for like, I like wrote the day he broke up with me. I mean, I was doing gratitude practice pretty religiously before. I haven't been doing
one
as much
of my
anymore.
Favorite things,
but I did. Yeah. And I wrote out all these things that I was grateful for. And so I kept focusing every day on like the gratitude of my life. And so much went away by being able to change my perspective.
Totally.
And then, I met Austin like a year later. And I felt like it. I mean, I fell in love with him and Austin's my best friend and I'm totally okay with doing things alone and he's totally okay with doing things alone. We're both very independent and like I'm not enmeshed like I used to be.
Right.
I'm not jealous. Like I don't worry about what he's doing. Like I have my own life. Like, I mean, of course we'll get in arguments. Usually it's like financial stuff over anything, but like we don't really fight that much. He's my best friend. And so, and I don't like, for example, if I would have been in a relationship previously during these phases of love addiction, I would have like checked out other guys, tried to make eye contact, tried to get their attention just to know that I was still wanted. And I don't need that validation anymore. Yeah. Like,
I mean, and you have to find that inside yourself too.
Yeah.
Like that's so important. I have a whole piece called It's an Inside Job.
Yeah.
And it's about all those things that really is that work that you have to do inside yourself, because it all comes down to your self-esteem and your confidence and how comfortable you are in yourself, that you're not seeking outside things to change how you feel on the inside.
Yeah.
Because it can be anything. You know, I talk a lot about all the different sort of addictions, so to speak, that we can have as addicted people, right? So just because I don't drink anymore doesn't mean that my desire to be compulsive is gone. So I've talked really openly about food issues, right? I can be very compulsive and unhealthy with food and sugar for sure. Boys was a long time ago for me, but I definitely had that thing and was super insecure and really was a terrible girlfriend to even have. But of course, then I picked the absolute worst people to date too, right? Too. Because I didn't feel good about myself.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just interesting. You still have all these compulsions and I love talking about the relationship part being one of those things, because we don't really talk about it enough.
Yeah.
And it's such a real piece. And it's also such a real part of taking people back out, you know, they go back out drinking or using drugs over heartbreak.
Yeah. That happened to me a lot.
It did. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I had not been sober for that long, but still I would be sober for a little bit of time and get in a relationship, and then they would hurt me and I would use.
Right. Yeah. And we say, you know, in 12 steps, we say, what are the things people relapse over most often? And it's romances and finances.
Yeah.
Because those things are really, really stressful.
Yeah.
And I think at the core of misusing any substance, or certainly abusing, being addicted to any substance, the core of it is that we're trying to change our feelings, right? The core of all of it is that I don't cope with feelings well.
Yeah.
So those are two things, finances and romances, that come with so much weight and so much emotion and so much insecurity and fear.
Yeah.
Right? We're just not going to deal with that stuff well.
Yeah.
I love it when people actually have the fortitude to not date in their first year. You know, I kind of welcomed that, but it is an ongoing struggle. Like in my sober livings, you know, I have men's sober livings. Like they're always talking about girls.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you guys have to be careful. Just be mindful.
Yeah, I
because
know.
We don't make those choices really well anyway.
Yeah.
Especially newly sober.
Yeah.
So you just have to be careful about that stuff, because it does put you at risk.
Yeah. Well, and I also remember people telling me you can't get in a relationship for a year. And I was like, F that. I'm not listening to you.
And see, I welcomed it. I was like, thank God, because I don't do that well anyway.
Not me. I was like, no way is that happening. I'm like, all right, I'll give it like, a month. Like,
a month should be good.
But I think finally, when I saw what was happening when I was in relationships, then I was like, okay, I'm going to do this, commit to this year thing for myself. I don't think the thing, though, is that everyone is at different points in their own misuse, abuse, like
absolutely.
Addiction. So there are some people who come in and were not at the point where I was, where like I was heavily, heavily addicted, homeless, psychosis, like pretty bad.
Yeah.
And there are other people who are just like, they just go to AA because they don't like the way alcohol makes them feel. So it's like to have a rule for them, like you can't, and they didn't have issues with men, you can't date for a year. It might be a silly rule. So it's just like, it depends on where someone is on the spectrum within their own.
That's a good point. I think it goes back to like we were talking about a little while ago, where you really have to be able to hold yourself accountable and be honest with yourself about where you are.
Yeah.
Because I had to do that. There were certain things in 12 steps that are kind of no-nos that I did, right? Like I had a male sponsor, which you're not really supposed to do. And he was my sponsor many, many years. He's still my favorite person in the world. I also, you know, I was a bartender my whole adult life. And when I got sober, I had never done anything else. So I continued bartending into my sobriety many years.
Yeah, that's
now tough. Listen, I don't tell anybody else to do that. Right? It just didn't bother me. Yeah. I was okay with it.
Yeah.
So it's just a different, it is. Everybody kind of is in their own space on that spectrum. But I will say this, if any of those decisions I made, like bartending, if it would have bothered me, I would have given it up immediately.
Yeah.
Because I was not messing around with my sobriety.
Yeah.
You know, it just was something that didn't, it just didn't bother me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Lara, tell everybody where they can find you now.
You can find me first via Instagram, which is Silly Lara. And then I also have my blog, larafraser.com.
I love that. I'm going to be probably binge reading your blog now.
Go ahead. Won't take that long because I don't have a ton up there.
And she said you guys might have heard Peaches. Peaches is the pet pig. So oh, yeah. I'll post some pictures of Peaches too because she's gorgeous.
Yeah, Peaches is, for any other reason, if you don't want to follow me, Silly Lara, I do post pictures of Peaches. So it's worth it for that.
So good. Yeah, that's where I originally saw her too. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, Lara, thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you for coming all the way to Florida to do this.
Yes, it was so good to meet you.
Yeah, so good IRL. To meet you too. I know. Look at you all hip.
Thank you. Maybe we'll do a follow-up eventually.
Awesome. I would love that.
Thanks.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast. Candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.